Welcome to the Yes Life Show on UK Health Radio. I'm Robin Daly, founder of the UK charity Yes to Life, that helps people with cancer to access and understand integrative medicine. In partnership with Progressive Communications, we've just completed a landmark online conference called Your Life and Cancer 2020. It ran across 2 weekends, with the first being angled towards those new to integrative medicine, and the second towards those wanting to learn more. If you missed the event, do not despair, as all the video recordings are available from yourlifeandcancer.com. Today's show is a sort of taster menu to give you a sense of the sheer breadth and quality of the sessions of the first weekend. So I won't waste any more time before plunging into the first session. To start out the weekend, we were honoured to feature Professor Robert Thomas, the UK's leading oncologist in the field of integrative medicine, in discussion with research scientist Dr. Marie Polly, setting the scene for the weekend. Here we hear them speaking about the real-world experience of bringing lifestyle medicine into an oncology department.
You're an oncologist, so you treat patients. They have chemotherapy, surgery, radiotherapy, kind of combinations of. But what else do you do additionally to that then that, you know, we start to call integrative medicine?
Hi, Marie, and thank you, Robin. It is a big honour to be the first speaker for this very prestigious conference, so good. But as you said, Marie, I'm a mainstream oncologist, so we do mainstream studies, we give chemotherapy, more and more biological treatments, etc. But, you know, at the end of the day, I have a person in front of me, not a number, and we want that person to do as well as possible. So they want to have the lowest side effects possible, and they want to have the best outcomes. And I don't believe that just giving a chemotherapy drug or just giving some radiotherapy will achieve the best outcomes. And from my experience of being an oncologist for 25 years and the research we've done and more research I read on a daily basis, it's very clear that patients can improve their outcomes by the way they choose to live their life, what they eat, maybe some supplements. So, you know, that this is what we're here for. We're here for to improve outcomes. So that's the motive behind it. There's nothing else apart from wanting people to do better.
Thank you. So is there something that particularly took you down this path as an oncologist? What got you interested in sort of the additional approaches that you're including?
Well, in the early days, about 20 years ago, it was all about trying to get people to understand their treatment options. And we did some research at that point showing very clearly that people who understood their treatment options and shared the decision-making process actually had less stress, they were less depressed. And so it was very obvious back then. So we designed videos and information sheets, which now is all routine, but at the time it was sort of novel. And then going on from that sort of patient empowerment type sort of process, more recently we realized it's not so much the information about their mainstream treatments, it was information about what they could do to help themselves was a bit lacking. Mainly because it's quite difficult to interpret the data.
Yeah.
So that's why we moved on to that, to say, you know, when someone says to me, what can I do to help myself? That you need to sort of summarize the world literature, and where there's gaps, we then decided to try and fill those gaps by designing our own studies. And that's why we formed a sort of lifestyle stroke complementary research unit linked to Bedford, Cambridge, local universities, and in fact, universities around the world. So we've designed and published a series of studies, which hopefully will give us the information so we can advise charities such as Macmillan and advise our own patients. So that was really the motive behind it, was just to sort of make sure we're giving the right advice.
Two of the leading figures in the integrative medicine scene in the UK come together next to discuss taking an integrative approach. In this clip, Dr. Catherine Zollman, Medical Director of Pennybrook UK, is asking Patricia Peat, the founder of Cancer Options, about the way she approaches a first consultation with someone diagnosed with cancer.
Patricia, when you're talking to somebody who's maybe starting off on this journey, what's your approach to the beginning of that conversation?
I listen a lot. I'm not, I get, you know, obviously I get to know about the cancer situation, but I'm actually more interested in the person. To me, you know, the lawyers are dealing with cancer. What you need to be, a lot of people, it's very shocking to be diagnosed with cancer. It's very traumatic. It turns your life upside down, your equilibrium, etc. And, you know, if somebody is frozen with fear from the point of diagnosis and dealing with that, you know, they can't absorb information, they can't take things on, they can't grow. There are times when people need to be told what to do, and I sometimes, you know, my client, will you just tell me what to do? Okay, I'll do that. Okay, it's fine. Yeah, so it's very much, I want to see that person become well physically, but I want to see them grow emotionally, I want to see them grow psychologically, and I want to see them empower themselves so that they see their doctors, they see everybody as part of their team that they are, you know, in charge of, and they are taking what they need from them.
I think that's lovely, and I think you're absolutely right, and to sort of talk about that listening, because I think sometimes the first thing that people need to do is just to stop and come back to themselves and mm-hmm. what matters to them. And I think in medicine, we're so focused on what is the matter with you, but actually we need to ask the question, what matters to you? Because that often unlocks the key to what's going to help somebody really thrive and develop and grow and be nourished.
Yeah, and the big change I've seen, because certainly when I started working in this area 20 years ago, it was a bit of a vacuum. The big change I've seen is I kind of used to spend a lot of time talking about why it's good to have an integrative approach, why the medical profession, unfortunately, not in a position to offer it to them or to discuss it. And I was kind of selling it a bit, if you like. Nowadays, that people come, they know. They know I can help myself. They know the things I can do. I just need some direction. You know, the people are coming informed, you know, which is fantastic.
The next session was a dive into the controversial world of nutrition. What's the right diet? What to avoid? When and how often to eat? The questions are endless. Fortunately, we had two top experts in nutrition to help us find our way, Kirsten Chick and Tural Shah. Here they tackle the question of the individuality of patients.
How do you decide what kind of diet to put them on? Because there are so many different approaches out there.
So I think we have to remember every single person's an individual. And I use functional medicine, which is a real systems biology kind of based approach, which looks at identifying the root causes of what might be going on. And I know that Catherine Zollman and Patricia Peets discussed this. It's about looking after the soil and looking at the environment and all those different things. So for me, it's really important to understand the person, their lifestyle, their cultural background, their, you know, their preferences, what is possible for them in their day-to-day kind of lifestyle. You know, if they're working, do they take the packed lunch and things like that? And I think all of these things make such a difference. We can't just go with this one size fits all approach. And, you know, diet is one part of it. Obviously, sleep, exercise, stress relief, you know, the environment, all of those things impact as well what you eat and how you know your body works. So those are the things I start to look at. I start to really get to know the person. It's really person-centric. And I think one of the things that's really important for me is that a lot of the advice that's certainly given in the Western world is very centered around Caucasian people and white people. And we have to remember that at least, you know, 14% of the UK identifies BAME, so that's Black Asian ethnic minorities, and their cultural preferences, our cultural preferences, what we eat is very different. And actually, a lot of the traditional diets actually do include a lot of different types of fruits and vegetables. It's when we kind of move towards this more standard westernized diet with all the processed food that, you know, it becomes problematic. So for me, it's really about working with people, with their lifestyle, with their family, with their environment and how it is for them, and understanding what's going to work. There's no point in recommending, oh, eat this. If they're not even eating the basics, let's say the, you know, five fruits and vegetables a day, then let's just start with that. We don't need to go full gung-ho until we've got the basics right. Let's get the low-hanging fruit, as, you know, I think Catherine Zollman said earlier.
Yeah, so true. And people get really overwhelmed. People think that sometimes people don't come to see me straight away when they want to because they are scared that I'm just going to radically change their diet and it's going to be too stressful and too strict. And you're absolutely right. It's not about that. It's really about working from where that person is right now. But what I also find is that there's so many diets out there. There's so many inspirational people that have really worked hard on their diet. And then they quite naturally shout about it and say, look, I've done this and it's been amazing. And it has been amazing. And then everybody wants to try and do the same thing and then gets a little bit disappointed when either it doesn't work for them or it doesn't feel right, they don't feel nourished, or it's a really stressful, difficult program for them to follow. And I spend a lot of my time explaining to people what you've just said, that it's very individual, that that approach might not work for you as an individual. Even if you've had the same diagnosis, your body is different, the climate might be different, there's so much that might be different, and where you're coming from is different. And it's so important, sorry, Toro, that you bring up the whole kind of cultural background aspect, because I work with people from lots of different cultural backgrounds as well, and I've had to really educate myself around that so that if I'm working, I'm not just prescribing a healthy Western version of a Western diet to them, that I'm really really accepting and honouring the diet that they're used to and that they're going to enjoy and feel comfortable with.
These days it's hard to avoid people extolling the virtues of the gut microbiome and its essential role in most aspects of health, and for a good reason. People with cancer would do well to take a focused interest in their gut health. Dr. Carol Granger and Miguel Toribio Mateus are both experts on the topic, and here we hear them discussing ways to build up your microbiome.
But I think in terms of treatment, the areas that all of us can think about with how the microbiome, how the power of the microbiome can be harnessed, is to improve the diversity, as we've said. And that does mean having a broad, if possible, broadly based plant-based diet. But the other thing is to actually take in good microbes in food where possible. So obviously one of the areas that I'm quite interested in as a nutrition practitioner is how do people get some good microbes? Because we've got some in there from when we're born and they, you know, they are affected by what we eat. But there are also some key foods that contain, some cultured foods that contain lots of good microbes that are beneficial to have. So they're things like yogurt and kefir, sauerkraut, kimchi, all of those contain positive live cultures. So they're described as probiotic foods or fermented foods or cultured foods. And all of those will add to your microbiome. So you're feeding your resident microbes with lots of different types of foods. But it's also really beneficial to take in foods that contain good positive cultures as well. Now, just obviously because within our audience today, there may be people that are having chemotherapy where they're told that they're very immunocompromised and then they're not allowed to eat live foods because their white cell count is very low. So what I'd say is always listen to your medical advisors. But even if you can't have live foods, you can still eat those good beneficial foods that will feed your own microbes. So I think at this point, it's worth maybe kind of making some definitions. So we can talk about prebiotic foods that feed good microbes. And then we can talk about probiotics and probiotic foods that actually supply good microbes. And for most people, having both of those is really a benefit. But for some people, they're not able to take the live cultured foods because they're immunocompromised. But they will be able to enjoy some of the prebiotics. So eating foods like apples, stewed apples, great, oats, beans, butter beans, all those different types of foods that are prebiotic foods that feed the good microbes. So it's maybe worthwhile at this point, because we're having a lovely discussion about diversity, but I omitted to make those two definitions. So the prebiotics are the foods that feed the good microbes, and the probiotics are the cultures themselves that you can get from different types of foods like yogurt, kefir, sauerkraut and kimchi.
Yeah,
and I know that you're a great fan of cultured foods, yeah.
I am a super fan, but also I was just thinking about the point of taking it slow, whether you are very immune compromised and you've been told to be very careful with these life cultures, or whether you just want to like take it slowly, because sometimes people just go completely enthusiastic with these things, and it's not a matter of more is better sometimes, but even tiny amounts of more diverse foods. So if you are relatively new to fermented foods and to symbiotics as well, which are kind of like in the middle, because they are giving you the fiber, the prebiotics that feed the bacteria, but they also contain some of the live bacteria there, you can make very small changes, like, just chopping a bit of cabbage that is naturally going to be a rich substrate for some bifidobacteria and some lactobacilli the moment that you expose it to a bit of water and a little bit of salt. So it's the initial process of making a sauerkraut kind of a process. If you just chop a little bit of cabbage, put it in water or brine, so a little bit of salt and water, and instead of leaving it there for completely airtight and for weeks and changing the water and so on, that would be how you would make it. Just do it for a couple of days and just leave it at room temperature, and you've got a little bit of bacteria and you've got the fiber, or even just put it in the fridge if you want to be completely safe and have it the following day, because there will be something more than what was originally in the cabbage. You've let some of the nutrients from the cabbage seep into the water and mix with those bacteria. So you're engaging, you're making the food a bit more alive. You're almost activating food in a way, and tiny amount of that and a tiny amount of kefir, and again, if you are compromised, then it could be, you know, tiny amounts of those things. If your medical practitioner is happy with that, that would be a nice place to start. And if you're not compromised and you just want to start from nearly zero, my advice would be try different ferments and different fibers, even if it is a tiny amount of each of those, and change, diversify throughout the week, so you're not having the same thing over and over again.
Supplementation is a complex field that deserves a lot of attention, but also a lot of expertise. Self-medication is not an advisable route for those with cancer, really. For our session on supplementation, we had a discussion between two medical doctors who've gone on to train in integrative medicine, Dr. Danny Gordon and Dr. Sally Moorcroft.
Now we've got the big question. I don't know who's doing this, me or you.
Go for it.
So, okay, this is a really nice question as well, because I think this session also needs to be quite positive. So I think we're kind of saying be careful all the time. But there are lots of things that can be used safely too. And I guess this question is about what we maybe use the most of in practice. So although we're obviously talking about treatments being very individualized and tailoring in for patients depending on, you know, all of the things we've discussed, there's also supplements which crop up time and again, mainly because they've got the most evidence behind them and because they're the most easy to use. And obviously some of them still have caveats that you do need to be careful with, particular say for example particular chemo therapy agents or you know, particular other health conditions or have interactions. But in general, these, I guess, are the safer ones and the ones that we generally use the most of. So we've kind of put a list together. I don't know, we could maybe just kind of talk about
them. Yeah, just go through it. Yeah. Yep.
So the first one, I guess, is the fish oils. So they're generally, they're fantastic anti-inflammatory. Obviously, you know, like we said, you can get them from food. But in higher dose, in a supplement form, they can be really beneficial for helping support the immune system and as an anti-inflammatory. As we talked about, you know, they may increase bleeding time. So you do need to be careful with any kind of anticoagulants or before surgery. I don't know, do you want to talk about anything else about the fish oils, Danny?
I think, you know, certainly when you're going through chemotherapy, it can affect many, many different body systems, and anything we can do to support brain health, I think, is really important. And sometimes the earlier you start with the stuff, the better. A lot of people with chemotherapy end up with what I call chemo brain, which usually goes away. but and we can repair the damage after, but sometimes starting with these things that are really safe for most people, again, always check with your team to make sure it's right for you. But that's one of the things I really like about the fish oils, is it's really safe, and it is quite a nice like brain health supplement generally. Yeah. And especially since our diet, as you know, Sally, you know, we used to have a really nice ratio of omega-3s, yep, which are those really important fish oils, versus omega-6, which is kind of the more inflammatory pathway. And in the Western diet now, it's about, you know, 1 to 200 versus it should be 1 to 4. So it just kind of, it's not a license to eat really high inflammatory foods all the time, but certainly it can really help. And it can be calming for some people as well.
Yeah, and can help with mood content. And the other thing to say, obviously, we're talking about fish oils. So, but for vegetarians and vegans, I usually recommend the algae-based, so they're much more accessible for the body to use, rather than say a hemp oil or a flax oil, which actually you do have to process quite a lot to be able to get the EPA and the DHA from. So I generally tend to go for the algae oils. And also, people don't really like fish, and you know, you can get a bit of that fishy breath afterwards, can't you, with some of the supplements. So some people do prefer the vegan ones.
Next, we had an incredible session with one of the most respected practitioners in integrative medicine in the US, Dr. Lise Alschuler. She was speaking about the overview of integrative medicine to Dr. Catherine Zollman, Medical Director of Pennybron UK.
So to me, integrative oncology is really a both-and approach, not an either-or approach. So it's, I often talk to my patients about, you know, when they've been diagnosed with cancer, cancer does not play nice ever. It is aggressive by nature. It is destructive, and it needs to be stopped. And so we need to pull out the strongest, most powerful tools that we have to stop that cancer, essentially, and to, at the same time, ideally, support the health and vitality of the person. So we are going to lay out all of the tools on the table, pull their labels off. I don't care if it's conventional or so-called natural. I want to use the best tools for that person. So how we choose those tools is really a matter of determining at various phases along that journey, what do we need that's going to, what can provide us the most powerful way to stop the cancer in its tracks? And what is most likely to do that with the least amount of harm. So there's always this kind of benefit harm seesaw that we're on, and we want the most benefit and least harm. That's not always perfect, right? We know that, for example, chemotherapy, which is super powerful, can also be very harmful. So in that case, then we have to say, well, how can we get that seesaw tipped back up so that there's less harm? Are there some complementary therapies that will support or minimize that harm, not cause interference, not add to potential harm in any way, but, and maybe even in fact support those conventional treatments? So it becomes, yes, an art, but it's really, I think, an art, an informed art, an art that's based on our understanding of science and the published evidence that we have on various things.
I love that. I think that's so helpful to that idea of, let's take off the labels, let's not make one kind of treatment friend and another kind foe. And certainly in my work, a lot of, you know, it's really helpful. People tell me that when they go to the hospital, although they're prescribed these treatments, most of the information they're given is about the potential side effects, not actually about the potential benefits of the chemotherapy and the radiotherapy and how they work and an explanation of how they can be your friend. So actually, I think I love that idea about really helping people feel behind whatever treatment combination they've got and feel like they're not resisting or fighting one kind of treatment, but are seeing it as part of a whole treatment package, which together is the best, provides the best sort of combination approach with the least, as you say, the least side effects possible, but the most power.
Right. I think another way to think of that is that when we have a disease like cancer, we need medicine, and sometimes we need strong medicine. And, you know, chemotherapy, for example, is strong medicine, but that's what we need to help us with this dis-ease in our body. But I just want to make it very clear that, in my opinion, it's a travesty, actually, that people most people are only given the option of the strong medicine and are not also given tools that they can employ to improve their health, their vitality, reduce their risk of recurrence, maximize their ability to handle this strong medicine. And I think that for me, that's really what is so powerful about integrative medicine, is that it involves the patient in their own journey in a much more proactive way, and in a way that can help them overcome the disease, but also in overcoming the disease, put them very squarely on the path towards greater health.
We started on Sunday with one of the most authoritative voices in the UK on the subject of the mind-body connection and the many aspects of the psychological and emotional experience of cancer, Sophie Savage. Here we hear her tackling a deeply challenging question that she's grappled with personally.
Can we manifest something to another person, like my fear on my daughter, i.e. You actually pass on, if you like, your fear for them to them?
Truthfully, yeah, you can. Now, you're not the cause of all their fear, because they have their own little psychology and their own little minds making things up and scaring themselves. But do children pick up on their anxiety? For sure, our anxiety, for sure they do. I don't think there's a right answer to this as a parent. I think every parent needs to discern their way. But the research shows that if we don't tell our kids what's going on, they feel something's going on, then they make things up about what's going on, and they often think that they've done something wrong. There's a huge amount of research about that. So I really encourage honesty and transparency with our kids, so that they're not making things up and not believing it's them, and we can help them with their fear as well. I mean, the last time I was told I had new brain tumors, my daughter John told her, she came running into my bedroom, threw her arms around me, she's 10, burst into tears and said, "Mommy, are you going to die?" And we just cried together on the bed. And I just let her cry, and I cried, and we cried. And I'm very emotionally transparent with her, actually. And then I said to her, and I've said this before, "Darling, when I know I'm going to die, I will tell you, I promise. So meantime, you just go cartwheeling back into your life." And she went, "Okay." And off she went into the garden, completely fine, because she knows I'm going to tell her. And I said, "Until you hear me say Mummy's dying, you have just get on with your life." And she does. So it's not easy to do that with kids, but the more open we can be, the less anxiety they will have.
Fantastic advice. I know this is something you've given a lot of attention to, and I think there'll be a lot of people listening who that would have been really helpful to.
Next, the new wonder drug, exercise. The evidence for its effectiveness is so compelling that Professor Robert Thomas is a massive advocate, and he's speaking here to Lizzie Davis, an ex-oncology nurse who's long specialised in exercise for those with cancer.
Exercise really is like a medicine. It really is a wonderful, wonderful medicine. And it's something that comes with very few side effects, providing you dose it according to you, according to how you are. But in terms of the benefits that you can get from moving your body, whether it's 5 minutes, 20 minutes, you know, a little bit longer, is huge. And let's not forget that exercise actually has the most wonderful impact on pretty much all the systems in your body simultaneously. And I'm not sure there's any drug that can do that. So I like to see exercise really as this just potentially wonderful medicine. And it might be that you start taking this wonderful medicine very slowly to begin with. So a small dose and very, very slowly. But then, you know, just knowing and understanding just the impact it can have on all the systems in the body in such a wonderfully nourishing way that can run alongside your treatment and boost hopefully your body, your mind, you know, in so many ways. So I think, you know, yes, the starting out is difficult, trying to tether people into the mindset of exercise, but maybe seeing it as a wonderful medicine that can run alongside all the other treatments and help to replenish when those treatments are kind of obviously having quite negative impacts at times. Exercise can be something that, I'm not saying it is a magic bullet, but it can be something, and there's so much data, there's so much evidence out there to support that it will help and can help to negate so many side effects. I know that seems quite counterintuitive when you're in the midst of treatment, but it really, there is just so much evidence out there to support quality of life improvements, yes, muscle mass improvements, respiratory improvements.
So just that's good. So basically, we all need to be singing from the same hymn sheet. We need to reinforce the message. So get all the surgeons, the oncologists, the radiologists, and nurse all reinforcing. It's a very vital, integrative part of their routine management, which is not seen as an additional sort of fluffy thing on the side. It's actually
The next session was called The Importance of Emotional Support and Managing Stress. There were very few speakers who didn't mention stress, whatever their particular specialism. In this crucial session, Dr. Lauren McDonald, herself a stage 4 cancer survivor, speaks to Dr. Catherine Zollman about the biology of stress.
Many of you who joined us for the first session this morning will have heard from Sophie Savage about her real sense, both lived experience but also from her psychological background and her reading of the research, about how much the biology of our bodies changes when we are in different emotional states. So she talked a little bit about the biology of fear and what that does to the body, but what about unpacking that for us in a little bit more detail, Lauren, because I know this is something that you care a lot about.
Yeah, so first of all, thank you so much for having me, Catherine and Robin. I've been watching a few of the previous sessions and it is such an amazing summit, so I'm just so happy it's happening. And I watched Sophie's amazing talk earlier as well, and it really spoke to a lot of the things that I think we were also planning on discussing in this session. And it just shows that the idea of stress and emotional support and the fear response or the stress response, whatever you want to call it, is so important. And it's something we all need to address in any cancer journey. And like Sophie, I was never asked through any of my appointments how I was actually feeling. So to give anyone watching a little bit of a background, in 2014, I was diagnosed with cancer, so malignant melanoma. And then over several years, I progressed to stage 4. And you'd have thought at some point during that journey, and I did bounce around between different hospitals, different oncologists, different nurses, and nobody ever turned to me and said, "How are you doing? How are you coping?" And on top of that, I wasn't only moving hospitals, I actually had moved, I'd split up with a partner I'd been with for a long time, 8 years, I'd moved house, I'd moved back to my parents' house in Devon, so I'd really lost my social support network. I'd been living in Brighton for 8 years prior to that. So the whole topic of social support and emotional support is really, really kind of very personal to me, because I know what it's like to have that all taken away from you. And I had to really go on a journey of building up my emotional kind of network again, and then also my own inner resilience. And to come all the way back to your point, Catherine, about actually kind of just addressing what is stress and why do we have this stress response and what's going on in the body, it's so inbuilt in us as humans. You know, for evolutionary purposes, we are meant to actually experience stress. Stress isn't always bad. And you'll so often the examples given of an animal running on the Sahara being chased by a lion, and they are meant to have that stress to mobilize them to be able to run, and then afterwards they shake it all off. And as humans living in the modern day, we just don't do that. We live in this state of stress so often, be it doesn't even have to be anything to do with cancer, just our day-to-day lives, be it job stress, family stress, and we have this stress response, and that's all down to our autonomic nervous system. So without going too much into biology lesson, we have this autonomic nervous system, and we've got the sympathetic stress response on one side and then the parasympathetic stress response or relaxation response. And I'm sure you've all heard of this, so I don't want to teach you to suck eggs by going over it in too much detail, but really so many of us are living in that fight or flight sympathetic stress response. And like I said, it's okay for a short amount of time. We're actually meant to have, you know, a little bit of stress can even be good for us. It can motivate us to attend things like this, or, you know, go and do research. If we're talking about cancer, it can push us to go and look for research or empower ourselves. But then we can shift over and it can become chronic. And that really starts to affect our emotional health, mental health, and actually our physical health, which is obviously the physiology of our body. And what we're really talking about there is mainly the immune system with regards to cancer. So it's so important to address our stress response, really, and try and do everything we can to bring ourselves back into that parasympathetic state.
Testing is a relatively recent aspect of integrative medicine for cancer, and it brings with it huge benefits, but also huge challenges. Which test to have, how to prioritise when you're on a budget, etc., etc. Dr. Nina Fuller-Chavelle is a medical doctor who's gone on to train in functional medicine, and in this session, she talks to Joe Gamble, a functional medicine practitioner who's trained in integrative medicine for cancer.
As a practitioner, I tend to find lots of clients present lots of blood tests to me that they don't really understand. Blood tests that are done to check that they can go ahead with their chemotherapy. But yeah, most clients might understand neutropenia or low white blood cells, but don't really get any more information from their oncologists about how to support themselves to read these tests. So I'd like to kick off, Nina, by asking you a little bit more, just an oversight, maybe thinking about those white blood cells and those differentials. What can our clients learn from reading those tests to support them to really be in charge of their own journey, which is so important for them all?
Absolutely. On active treatment, like you said, we do get the panels of blood tests, and they vary actually from hospital to hospital in terms of what you're going to get and also what kind of treatment you're on. And the purpose of these tests, it's really important to understand that, because tests are only useful if they're done for a specific purpose, if they're going to change someone's management. Otherwise, it's just academic interest. So when we use them for chemotherapy, for example, in terms of active treatment, we'll look at cell counts. We're looking at whether the bone marrow that produces our blood cells is functioning well enough for somebody to go for another round of chemotherapy. So really, that's where the neutropenia comes in, and it's just a fancy word for having low neutrophils. And neutrophils are infection-fighting cells, and what happens is when the chemo knocks out a lot of the cancer cells, the impact is on other fast-dividing cells in our body, including the gut, which is why we get a lot of GI side effects with chemotherapy, but also the bone marrow, because again, they're fast-dividing cells. When the neutrophils drop below a certain point, that's usually where your oncologist will tell you that you might need to delay chemotherapy another round. And quite often then you might have a choice. You might just delay the chemotherapy round, or if you're consistently missing rounds or delaying rounds, you might be offered GCSF injections, so injections to boost your cell counts. And kind of everything has pros and cons, and that's something that be decided on their one-to-one basis. So that's usually the white cell count and differential. The most important thing to look for there, if you're in active treatment, is neutrophils. Before treatment, and I think that's something that you and I will talk about a bit later, you might want to look at the neutrophil to lymphocyte ratios, and that's a very, very specific thing that you want to look at before treatment. Other things that you might want to look at, again, you're looking at kidney function, liver function tests. So quite often these come up and they're important to see how well you're tolerating specific therapies. So sometimes on chemotherapy, your liver function might go up to an extent that actually is unhelpful, and you might be asked to stop chemotherapy earlier for that particular reason. When you're looking at immunotherapy, sometimes they can actually, the side effect of them is they can actually provoke autoimmune disease. So sometimes the oncologist might run some of the autoimmune disease markers or look for specific disorders if they're worried that that's what you're developing when you're on that particular course of treatment. So really, it's kind of a wide range of things, but it's designed, those bloods are purely designed to monitor the side effects of the active treatment you're on. They're not really designed to do anything else, and that's the important thing to keep in mind.
Next, we were treated to a really authoritative talk on toxins. Sarah Davenport, the founder of Breast Cancer Haven and a health writer, asked Dr. Jenny Goodman questions specifically related to environmental toxins and cancer.
Can we just start a little bit and talk about the heavy metals?
Where
they come from in our everyday life, and where their body puts them if it's not leaving them hanging around in the blood.
The body doesn't really know what to do with them, and it tends to put the metals, which are things like nickel, cadmium, aluminium, mercury and lead, those are the main five, it tends to put them where it would put their opposite numbers, which are the good metals. So minerals that are essential for our life, like zinc, potassium, magnesium, calcium and copper and so on, selenium, sulfur, it tends to put the toxic ones where the good ones were.
So which is like where?
For example, every enzyme, which is a protein that has a job of converting substance X to substance Y in the body, has on its huge molecule an active site, a place where a helper mineral like zinc should sit. Right. So nickel will go and sit there from excessive contact with stainless steel, which is 14% nickel, and from many, many other sources. Okay, and the sources are all listed in the book, but they're...
So one of the things that I've always been fascinated by is our cooking pots, the things that we use every single day to cook all our organic food. But I'm totally confused about... I've just got all these silver saucepans sitting under my sink. So how do I know if they're aluminium, if they're stainless steel? What should I be cooking with?
Okay, so aluminium, I would say, is a no-no, especially for breast cancer patients. They have found, particularly Professor Philippa Darbra of Reading University, has found definite evidence of aluminium in breast tumours. Mm-hmm. Because we get a lot of aluminium, not just from cooking pots, but from underarm deodorant. Whether it says aluminium or whether it says rock salt alum, it's aluminium, it goes in. Okay, the best supplement, the best substance for getting it out is silica. Silica is the only thing that pushes it out.
I drink silica water every day instead of the supermarket water, because I presume that you need to detoxify every single day, don't you? Not just for a couple of weeks at a time.
There are a few sources of aluminium, but I wouldn't say aluminium saucepans are a good idea for anyone, but stainless steel is okay for some people, depending what you cook in it. And this is the crucial thing. Mm. Stainless steel is 14% nickel. Nickel is toxic, but the nickel will only come out of that saucepan if you've put something acid in it. So the things not to cook in stainless steel are anything with tomato sauce, lemon juice, rhubarb, anything fruity, anything acid. But it's perfectly all right, I believe, to boil an egg or boil your rice in the saucepan, because there's nothing acid to draw out the nickel. If you've been a smoker, you will have cadmium on board. That's probably the most toxic heavy metal that we have. If you've stopped smoking for 10 years, we know the nicotine is gone, the tar is long gone from your lungs, but the cadmium is still there.
Do you get that out?
Okay. What helps get rid of it is high-dose vitamin C. Mm-hmm. And zinc, lots and lots of zinc.
And what do you quantify as a high dose of vitamin C? Because there's a huge kind of diversity.
Okay, so everybody has a personal maximum dose that they can tolerate. And I detail that towards the end of the book. And it's called Finding Your Vitamin C Bowel Tolerance. Mm-hmm. So you start off with a tiny dose. What in this context is a tiny dose? Half a gram at breakfast, half a gram at dinner. And you build up by half a gram or a gram per day, spreading the dose out as much as you can. And at some point, usually about 20 grams, you'll get the runs. So then you go down to the previous day's dose. That's your personal maximum, and it may change as time goes on.
And do you keep to that every single day, or just for an intense...
I would say for most people, 6 months is enough to do the job. And then you're down to a gram or two a day, which is enough to keep COVID at bay, I believe.
Mindfulness is finding its way into more and more aspects of life, not least of all cancer, one of the more challenging experiences life can throw at our mind. Mindfulness instructor Claire McCluskey talked to Professor Linda Carlson, a respected leader in the field, about the many ways it can support us through cancer and the science behind it.
The thoughts that come and how we can sort of start bringing kindness. And actually, I find that one of the most powerful things that in classes, people sort of just, you know, and for myself too over the years, just beginning to understand what kindness towards yourself really means. Because actually, yeah, you're being kind to yourself. You don't know. You have to.
No, you suffer. You know, and so often one way to think about that is it's easier for us to be kind and compassionate to other people. You know, so ask yourself, well, if this was my friend who was going through this cancer experience, how would I reach out to them? You know, you would have all sorts of compassion. So why can't you turn that around towards yourself? It's really essential.
Yeah.
Self-mindfulness. I often say to people in the class, because that's one of the barriers to sitting down every day and practicing, which is what we're trying to get people to do, you know, is this putting yourself at the bottom of the list, right? So you've got your list of things you're going to do today, and it's, you know, work, family, home, whatever it is. And if I have time, maybe I'll do something nice for myself, right? So it's low priority. And so what we say to people is that, okay, for this 2 months while you're doing this course, if you only do one thing today, make it be this, make it be your practice, your self-care. Because yeah, everybody knows you're no good to anyone else if you can't take care of yourself, right?
Yeah, do what makes you feel good first. You know, whether that is mindfulness or exercise or painting, but yeah, nourishing yourself first. And it's key, but it's quite a hard thing to learn to do.
An exciting highlight of the weekend was the discussion between top US oncologist Professor Donald Abrams and our own Professor Robert Thomas in the UK. It was fascinating to hear them comparing notes on a wide variety of topics. This clip focuses on the hot topic of cannabinoids.
But for the last 23 years now, I have been conducting research with the plant. I believe that the plant is the medicine. It has been a medicine for 3,000 years. Cannabidiol, or CBD, is one of the most, perhaps, well-known of the cannabinoids, which are at least 140 other chemicals, including delta-9 tetrahydrocannabinol, or THC, which I believe is the most potent cannabinoid. But CBD, or cannabidiol, has risen to the top of the most favored cannabinoid chart because it's non-psychoactive. And, you know, we live in a Puritan-based Judeo-Christian culture that believes that being high is not good. Well, I think if you have a terminal disease, or if you're at your end of life, or even if you just want to relax, being high is on cannabis, in my opinion, is a lot healthier than alcohol, which I know is a very provocative statement, but it's my belief. So I'm just about to give a number of lectures on cannabis and cancer care. I'm a big promoter of cannabis for symptom management, for nausea, vomiting, appetite, pain, sleep, anxiety, and depression. There is no evidence that CBD actually has any impact on any of those, mainly because it hasn't been studied. Mm-hmm. But unlike THC, which binds to our very dominant, densely populated cannabinoid 1 receptor in the brain, CBD not only antagonizes it, but it changes the shape of that receptor so it doesn't bind THC. So how CBD has become a $23 billion a year business in the United States, even increasing during COVID, is a mystery to me. I think it's a lot of placebo effect, to be honest. So I believe the real medicine is the plant, which has been utilized as a medicine for 3,000 years now. And it's unfortunate that you can't say the name in the UK.
Well, I think we can get away with saying the name, but it's interesting that GW, which is our sort of legal company who makes cannabinoids for, say, cirrhosis and epilepsy, they are using THC in their products as well. They're not just doing the CBD. The CBD in this country is because that's all you can get available. And even then, Facebook and PayPal and places like that are trying to phase you out by making it illegal, even to sell CBD in this country. But anyway, let's
hope. My goodness. Yeah.
There's a couple of questions. I think you've answered it already. One question was, what sort of ratio of THC and CBD do you feel is right? You mentioned using the whole plant. So
yeah. So, and you know, the different plants, different strains have different ratios. I believe that the CBD is present in the plant to modulate the effects of the THC. Yeah. So if you have something that has a 1-to-1 ratio, for example, which is the only ratio that's been studied by GW Pharmaceuticals in their drug nabiximols, it has a one-to-one ratio. It doesn't get you high and it doesn't make you hungry. Well, how does that work? I think CBD detracts from the adverse effects of THC, but I believe it also detracts from the beneficial effects. Right. We just did a study in patients with sickle cell anemia with pain. And it's the first time that we've ever studied a one-to-one ratio of THC to CBD. And it was 5%, 5%, so sort of low dosage of both. And my perception was that patients got more relief of pain using 3.5% THC alone than the 5%, 5%, because I believe CBD detracts from the beneficial as well as the psychoactive effects of THC.
Tara Flanagan works on the amazing Radical Remission Project, researching and collating information about factors behind so-called spontaneous remissions that turn out to not be nearly as spontaneous as you might imagine. In this clip, Tara talks about the important role of intuition.
And it kind of points to me to what a kind of fundamental thing the intuition is, to finding your way ahead through this sort of minefield of so many different possibilities of what you could do. And I think this is something that floors people a lot initially. Well, how on earth do I find my way forward? There's all this information. I think, well, how am I going to find out what's right for me? And we have this extraordinary facility, the intuition. And I'd like you to say some more about what has been found out about it through the project and everything and its importance.
Absolutely. Well, scientists have discovered that we have over 100 million neurons in our gut, literally in the location of our gut. And that is the same amount of neurons that you have in your brain. So what we know is that we do have an intuitive gut that is able to send signals out to the immune system, to other organs in the body without actively connecting with the brain. We know that, you know, many, many years ago, we had what is referred to as the reptilian brain, which operated on gut instincts. So if you heard a predator approaching, you would run. If there was a storm that was going to destroy your makeshift area, you would have to take cover. Over the years, those dangers have gone away. So we don't practice relying on our gut, and we have been trained essentially to rely on the prefrontal cortex, the thinking brain. And the problem with the thinking brain or the analytical brain is over time, it actually tries to override the gut. And that can be a little bit dangerous. And I'd love to just describe a story to you that Dr. Turner, a study I should say that Dr. Turner overturned when she was doing this research. And for starters, she was shocked when every one of the radical remission survivors said that intuition supported their healing path. And Dr. Turner is funny. She is a researcher, but she will also describe herself as interested in the woo-woo. And some people, I don't know if woo-woo is a term that you use in the UK, but...
I'm not sure about our audience here, but I'm sure some of them are familiar with that.
Okay, yep. Sure. So the woo-woo might be what you imagine of people sitting in a circle or chanting or going on about chakras or crystals or things like that. That might be how I would mostly describe woo-woo. But sometimes it's more about things that science hasn't necessarily paid too much attention to. So when she discovered that everybody was saying intuition, she was not sure what she was going to find out when she went and looked at studies. So she found a study that had taken place at Cornell University in New York City. And they hooked people up to a heart monitor and diodes that would measure their sweat glands opening or closing. And they set them in front of a computer that had two curtains on it. And they told the study subjects that they would be having to guess which curtain the object was behind. And the computer was going to randomly generate which curtain the object would be behind. And they were to click the curtain with their mouse to predict which curtain the object would be behind. And what they discovered was that when the subjects picked the correct curtain, their sweat glands remained closed, their heart rhythm was nice and rhythmic. And when they clicked the incorrect curtain, their heart rate sped up and their palms began sweating. But the most shocking thing that they discovered was that the body always knew which curtain the object was going to be behind. So the body was actually able to predict which curtain the object was behind before the thinking brain got a hold of it. And the scientists were concerned about reporting this research because they thought, this is not possible. This is not what science would have predicted. But what they discovered is that when the heart rate would elevate and the sweat glands would open, it would be when the thinking brain began to override the gut instinct, and the research subjects would report thinking things like, well, it can't be that curtain because the object was just behind that curtain two times in a row. So even though their body knew that that's where the object was going to be, their mind talked them out of it. And the crazy thing that the researchers discovered was that the body was actually able to predict, again, what curtain the objects were behind seconds before the computer generated the answer.
Well, I hope that's created a thirst for more. Go to Your Life and Cancer, where you can sign up for the full set of recordings. And a quick early warning of a fun fundraiser for Yes to Life is on the 10th of December. We're having a virtual dinner packed with competitions, prizes, entertainment and more. Check it out in the events section of yestolife.org.uk. Next week in the Yes to Life show here on UK Health Radio, I shall bring you a similar taster menu from the second weekend of Your Life and Cancer 2020. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.